Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good evening, everyone. Okay, we've been studying the Maha Malankya Sutta. This is Sutta number 64 in the Majjhima Nikaya. Before we go further, I have to correct myself over something that I said last week. You know, when I was explaining the paragraph number 3, this is the paragraph where the Buddha is answering Malankyaputta, and he says that the wanderers of other sects might confute you with the simile of this young infant lying on its back. Then the way I had just understood it, looking at it while I was teaching, I was explaining it as if the wanderers of other sects were bringing up the argument that the underlying tendency to these five fetters lies within the infant. And then I said that it doesn't seem conceivable that the wanderers of other sects could have this understanding of the underlying tendencies, because this seems to be a discovery special to the Buddha, something quite particular to the Buddha's teaching. But then after the class, Peter came up to me and said that the way he understood the paragraph, that the Buddha in this sentence was not explaining the way the wanderers of other sects would be refuting the monk Malankyaputta. But this was the Buddha was bringing in his own position here to refute the understanding of Malankyaputta. Malankyaputta's understanding was that, at least the way the commentary explains it, is that the fetters only exist when they actually arise in a person. So it's only when a person is actually holding a view of self that he's fettered by identity view, or only when a person is in a state of doubt that he's fettered by doubt. Only when a person is in a state of sensual desire that he's fettered by sensual desire. And so the wanderers of other sects would point out that a young infant lying on his back doesn't even have an idea of a self, so how can he have a view of self? He doesn't even have a view of different teachings, so how can he have doubt about the teachings? He doesn't even have an idea of sense pleasures, so how can he have sensual craving, sensual desire? Okay, so that's the argument that the wanderers would present. But what the Buddha is saying is that even though this is the case, but still the underlying tendency to these different defilements still lies within the young, tender infant lying on its back. So that's the Buddha's position. It's not the position of the wanderers of other sects. Okay, so please correct that. Okay, so last week we got as far as paragraph 7. And here the Buddha says the Buddha announces that there is a path, a way to the abandoning of the five lower fetters. And he says, if anyone is to abandon the five lower fetters, then they must do so by relying on this path. And then he uses, to illustrate this, he uses a simile of a great tree which is standing possessed of heartwood. The heartwood is the solid hardwood at the center of the tree. And so in order to extract the heartwood from the tree, one has to cut through its bark and the softwood, the sapwood. Only then can one reach the heartwood at the core of the tree. And so, in the same way, in order to eradicate the five lower fetters, one has to do so depending upon this path, this particular path. Then the Buddha introduces another simile. It seems that this simile is being introduced, the way I would understand it, is to show the possibility of attaining arahantship or nirvana by relying upon this path. So he gives a simile of the river Ganges full of water to the brim, and then a weak man might come by thinking that he will swim across the river Ganges with the strength of his arms, and yet he wouldn't be able to get safely across. And so when the Dhamma is being taught to someone for the cessation, the original text said cessation of personality, here it better to translate cessation of identity, but the idea, it can't really be rendered satisfactorily by any English translation. It's the cessation of Sakkaya in Pali. Sakkaya is the complex of the five aggregates subject to clinging, the Panchupadana Khanda. That is, it's the compound or complex, or let's say the organic unity of bodily form, feeling, perception, the volitional formations, and consciousness. So those are the five aggregates, which the Buddha says are dukkha. And the cessation of the five aggregates is actually nibbana. And so if the mind doesn't enter into this in the sense of leaping out towards it, launching out towards it, and acquire confidence, steadiness, and resolution for the attainment of that, then one can be regarded as like a feeble man. But then in the contrasting part of the simile, again, the river Ganges is full of water, but a strong man comes along thinking that I can swim across with the strength of my arms and get safely across to the further shore. In this case, the Buddha says, this man would be able to get safely across. And so too, when the Dhamma is being taught to someone for the cessation of Sakkaya, for the cessation of the five clinging aggregates, or we could say for the attainment of Nibbana, if his mind enters into it, that is, the mind launches out towards it and acquires confidence, becomes serene, and become steady and resolute in following the path towards that goal, then he can be regarded as like the strong man. Okay, and now, to continue, the Buddha now raises the question, what exactly is this path, this way to the abandoning of the five lower fetters? And let's remember what the five lower fetters are. Let me now just list all of the 10 fetters so we can see all of the 10 fetters together. How is the third one translated there? Okay, now I prefer to translate wrong grasp of rules and observances. Because if you get adherence to rules and observances, then they think, yippee, we don't have to follow any rules. Fourth is sensual desire. Fifth is given ill will, is it? Ill will. And sixth is given as, how is it translated? Let's say desire for forms, fear, resistance. Oh, I see, that's not actually, yeah, the 10 fetters aren't there. Sorry. In Pali, it's rupa raga. It's desire for form, sphere, existence. Seventh is desire for formless existence, formless sphere, existence. Eighth is conceit. Ninth is restlessness. And tenth is ignorance. Now, usually in the texts, when the Buddha explains how the different paths are attained in sequence, or the different stages of realization are attained in sequence, the first stage of realization, first stage of penetration of the Dhamma, which is a stage of stream entry, is said to eliminate or to eradicate the first three fetters. Sakkaya ditti, that's identity view, doubt, and wrong grasp of rules and observances. Then the second stage, and one who makes that penetration becomes a stream enterer, one who has entered the stream of the Dhamma, who has entered the path to liberation. Okay, the second stage doesn't actually cut off any new fetters, but it weakens the remaining greed, hatred, and ignorance, so that the disciple then becomes a once returner. The stream enterer can be reborn up to 7 times in the human world or the heavenly worlds. But after reaching the second stage of realization, by weakening greed, hatred, and ignorance, one becomes a once-returner, which means that one will be reborn at most only one more time in the sensual sphere of existence. Then the third stage of realization, third penetration of the Dhamma, eliminates the remaining two fetters, sensual desire and ill will, so that one becomes a non-returner. When one eliminates sensual desire and ill will, one will never be reborn again in the sensuous realm of existence, but one will be reborn in one of the higher realms, the form realm. Usually it's said the non-returner will be reborn in what are called special heavenly realms reserved for them, the pure abodes. And then with the fourth and final penetration of the Dhamma, one eradicates the five higher fetters, and one then becomes an arahant, one who is completely liberated in this very life. Okay, so now what the Buddha is going to teach here is a path and way to the abandoning of the five lower fetters. And before I come around to explain exactly how I understand this phrase, let us go through the first passage, the first method for abandoning the five lower fetters. Then I'll give the particular understanding that I've worked out for this idea of abandoning the five lower fetters. Okay, here the text begins in a rather unusual way for introducing the first jhana. I don't know the reason for this unusual introduction, but it says, with seclusion or separation from the acquisitions. This is, the word used here is upaddhi, which the commentary explains as objects of sensual pleasure, could be taken as material possessions. And with the abandoning of unwholesome states, and the commentary explains the unwholesome states as the five mental hindrances, and with the complete tranquilizing of bodily inertia. I'm not sure that I agree so much with the commentary. The commentary explains bodily inertia as being, but explains the Pali word as being kaya dutula. Literally it means something like corruption of the body. But the commentary explains it as meaning laziness, bodily laziness, slothfulness of the body. But it seems to me that it's being used with another noun, patipasaddhya, which is well translated as tranquilization or subsiding. So what subsides, what becomes tranquilized, is not something like inertia, laziness, or indolence, but usually it's agitation or excitement. And I think this is what one experiences when one sits down for meditation, even if one is relatively calm, but still there's little bits of restlessness, a little excitement, agitation in the body. And so when one first sits down, it takes the first few minutes for that bodily agitation, bodily excitement to subside. So that's what I would understand by this kaya dutula. Though I don't have any authority to support my understanding. But it seems to agree first with direct experience. And also it goes better with the noun patipasaddhya, tranquilization. Okay, then we come to the usual formula for the first jhana. Quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states. And the way the commentary explains seclusion from the acquisitions and with the abandoning of unwholesome states, the two phrases are just saying the same thing. So I don't know the reason why those two phrases are put in this formula here. Anyway, a bhikkhu enters and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. Okay, this is the normal formula, the usual formula for the first jhana. Okay, now, if we read the sutta, if we continue on and read the sutta just on its own terms, it seems as if the monk is doing this contemplation within the jhana itself. One doesn't see the text giving any impression that he's coming out from the jhana. But the way the commentary explains it, that one doesn't do, you see, the contemplation that's going to take place after this description of the jhana is contemplation of insight. And in the commentarial way of explanation, one doesn't do insight meditation within a jhana itself. Because within the jhana, the mind is fixed on one object. And it can't move amongst different objects, which is what takes place when one is investigating the different factors of this jhana. So in the commentarial way of explanation, what happens is that after spending some time within the jhana, stabilizing it, one comes out of the jhana back to a sort of state of consciousness which is somewhere, say, halfway between normal consciousness and the jhana consciousness. So that the impression of the jhana consciousness is still very clear and very strong, but one is not in the jhana itself. Because within the jhana, the vitakka and vichara, the faculty of thought, or the factor of thought and examination, are fixed immovably upon their object. And so one can't use thought and examination or applied and sustained thought to examine different phenomena. And so one comes out from the jhana, but one still has the impression of the jhana very strongly on the mind. And then one looks into that jhana consciousness and one sees whatever exists there of material form, feeling, perception, the mental formations and consciousness. That is, one takes the jhana consciousness or the jhana experience, the state of jhana, which has been experienced as something very blissful, very joyful. The mind has been unified, deeply absorbed in that state of bliss and rapture, but now drawing back from that state of jhana, one can look at that state and see that it is just a combination of these five aggregates, and one can dissect the jhana, analyze the jhana into the five aggregates. One can discern in it the aspect of form, which would be the particular visual object that, say, the mind has been focused on. It could be the nimitta, that is the sign or visible impression that the mind has been focused upon. That would count as form. Then there would be a feeling within that jhana, that state of pleasure, that would be the feeling. There would be a perception of the object. There would be different mental formations relating to the object. And there would be the consciousness, that is the awareness of the object. And so that jhana, that experience of jhana, which seemed to be so solid, so unified, has now revealed itself to the scalpel of investigation to be a compounded phenomenon, something which is put together, compounded out of the five aggregates. Or it's a complex phenomena constituted out of the five aggregates. And then having seen the jhana as made up of the five aggregates, one investigates these five aggregates in terms of the three characteristics of existence, that is, impermanence, suffering or unsatisfactoriness, and selflessness, anicca, dukkha, anatta. But here the text, in order to sort of strengthen the impression of the three characteristics, the text expands the three characteristics into 11 different ways, 11 different modes one can view these phenomena of the five aggregates. Though 11 are mentioned, they fall under the three characteristics. One sees them as impermanent, as dukkha, as a disease, this is rogato, as a tumor or a boil, as a barb or a dart, as a calamity, as an affliction, as alien or foreign, as disintegrating, then as void or as empty, this is sunya, sunyato, and as not self, anattato. Of these 11 aspects, two of them come under the characteristic of impermanence, that is, impermanent and disintegrating belong to the characteristic of impermanence, because disintegrating, palokato, means that it's falling apart, coming apart, moment after moment after moment. So that's an aspect of impermanence. Then three aspects belong to the characteristic of non-self. That is, one sees these five aggregates as being alien or as other. So one is seeing them as other than oneself, as empty or void. The five aggregates are void of any self, of any substantial reality. And they're not self, so that's the characteristic of not self, direct characteristic of not self. And then the other six angles or aspects for viewing the five aggregates are different aspects of the characteristic of suffering. Suffering, disease, tumor, dart, calamity, affliction, six. Okay, and then as one is contemplating the five characteristics in terms of these 11 modes, one is arriving at deeper and deeper stages of insight knowledge. So one is realizing the deeper insight knowledges until one reaches a point where one finds that one has become completely disenchanted with these five aggregates, and the mind starts to turn away from them, seeking that which is not disintegrating, not falling apart, not impermanent, that which is truly blissful, secure. And thus one turns the mind away from these states and directs it towards the Amita Dhatu, that's the deathless element, which is Nibbana. And then one reflects on Nibbana. This is in the preliminary stage, one is reflecting on Nibbana as this is peaceful, this is sublime, that is the stilling of all conditioned formations, the relinquishing of all attachments, the destruction of craving, dispassion, cessation, Nibbana. So in the earlier stage, one is reflecting in this way, but when the mind reaches the peak of insight knowledge, or of insight wisdom, then spontaneously the mind just turns away from the conditioned phenomena and directly, you could say the mind pierces through all conditioned phenomena and penetrates into the reality of the deathless element, seeing the deathless element with clear vision. And then when this happens, the text says that if one is steady in that, if one can hold to that vision and remain firm in it, then one attains the destruction of the asavas, of the taints. That is, one eradicates all of the defilements at once. But what often happens is that as one undergoes that experience, there comes a subtle liking for the experience, a subtle delight in that experience, a subtle clinging to it comes in as a kind of corruption of that experience. And so one is not able to remain steady in that realization of the deathless, but this desire or this grasping after the experience comes in, and this delight in the experience. And that is what is meant here by this desire for the Dhamma, delight in the Dhamma. And that is not like ordinary craving or ordinary delight, but this is very, very highly refined, very sublime delight, very, very sublime type of of craving or attachment, but it's still an attachment, and because of that it blocks the full eradication of the defilements. And because that blocks the full eradication of the defilements, instead of reaching the destruction of the taints, then one destroys the five lower fetters and emerges from that experience as a non-returner. One who is due to reappear, to take rebirth spontaneously, that is, in the form realm. I don't think non-returners invariably take rebirth in the pure abodes. I'm not sure that that's the case. but they necessarily take rebirth outside the sensual realm. So they take rebirth spontaneously, and there where they take rebirth, attain final nibbana without ever returning from that world back to the sensual realm of existence. And so this is the path, the way to the abandoning of the five lower fetters. In this passage, all the years since I first encountered it many, many years ago used to cause me a lot of puzzlement, because in the traditional Theravada commentarial way of explaining the different stages, one has to go through these four stages successively, through the stage of stream enterer, once returner, non-returner, and then to the stage of arhatship. And so the way that Theravadan commentaries would explain what happens when the Buddha speaks about the abandoning of the five lower fetters, they would say that what actually happens is that first one reaches the first stage of penetration, then very quickly one comes out from that, then immediately one comes back into contemplation, reaches the second stage of penetration, then comes out and immediately goes back into contemplation and reaches the third stage of realization. So the three stages take place very quickly, one after another, maybe with almost lightning speed, but one has to go through all three stages, one after another. But when we read the sutta, if you just take the sutta on its own terms and not bring in any kind of explanatory scheme, it doesn't appear that way at all. If you just take the sutta on its own terms, by practicing in this way, one can reach the eradication of the five lower fetters all in one shot. Doesn't that seem to be the case? And sometimes when there are some suttas where, for example, the Buddha teaches a Brahmin the Dhamma, and then while the Brahmin is sitting there listening to the Buddha's sermon, he gains the Dhamma eye, realization of the Dhamma. And then he goes off and takes his leave of the Buddha. A little while after he passes away, then the monks come to the Buddha and tells the Buddha, such and such a Brahmin has passed away. What is his destiny? Where has he been reborn? Then the Buddha says, when that Brahmin listened to me, he had a mind of deep confidence. Such and such a Brahmin has cut off the five lower fetters and has been reborn in the pure abodes, and has been spontaneously been reborn, and he will not return to this world. So this seems from this text that the Brahmin, while sitting there, when he gained realization, he gained the realization all in one shot, eliminated the five lower fetters. There are even a few suttas. The most notable is the famous Bahya Dharuchirya Sutta, where an ascetic named Bahya, who thought he was an arhant, but then some deity came to him and told him, you are not an arhant, you're deluded about your attainment, go see the Buddha. He is the true enlightened one in the world. And so this Bahia went hurriedly across hundreds of miles from the area where Bombay is now to Savatthi or Rajagaha to see the Buddha. And then when he met the Buddha, he was so anxious to get a teaching from the Buddha that he went to find the Buddha when the Buddha was on his arms round. And he pleaded, begged with the Buddha, please give me a teaching. I can't even wait for you to finish your arms round. And then the Buddha gave him a very concise teaching. And it said that while Bahia was standing there listening to the Buddha's teaching, he gained arahantship right on the spot. And there's nothing in the text about him going through one stage after another, but it seems that they all took place just with one penetration that he reached the final realization. And so it seems to me that if we just stay with the words of the sutta, that what the Buddha is explaining here is the way, not simply the way to the stage of non-returner that might progress by going through the stage of first stream enterer, then once returner, then non-returner, but this is the way to eliminate the five lower fetters all at one shot, beginning from the stage of a worldling. That's a puttojana, let's say the wise, instructed worldling who has confidence in the teaching. And then when one practices the jhana, by attaining the first jhana, one has to overcome the five hindrances. And amongst the five hindrances, what are the first two hindrances? Right. The first two hindrances are sensual desire and ill will. And those are also two of the five fetters, and those are the two fetters that keep beings tied or bound to the sensuous realm of existence. And so a person who has gained the jhana, the first jhana, hasn't cut off the fetters of sensual desire and ill will, but that person has weakened these fetters of sensual desire and ill will to the extent that they are not active in the mind. They're now just reduced to the anusaya stage. But because they have been suppressed and now exist only at the anusaya stage, this is the way I understand it, when this person gains penetration of the Dhamma, gains the insight into the truth of the Dhamma, using the jhana as a basis, it's quite possible, not inevitable, but quite possible, that with the strength of the jhana supporting it, that realization can cut off the five fetters all at once. And if the first jhana is not a strong enough basis, then the practitioner can go on to the second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana, until one finds a level of samadhi strong enough as a basis for that insight to penetrate through and to cut off the five fetters all at once. And I found recently that this way of explanation is supported by the other great commentarial Abhidharma system which developed in India, which is included within or explained within the work called the Abhidharma Kosha, the Savastivada system. That system, it's extremely complex, but it explains that a yogi meditator who has achieved the jhana of the form sphere and then achieves realization of the Dhamma can then cut off the defilements pertaining to the defilements corresponding to these five lower fetters all at once without having to go through the sequence of stream enterer, once returner before reaching non-returner. But one can go straight from an ordinary person, or let's call it a, not really an ordinary person, but from an unenlightened jhanic meditator to a non-returner with one penetration or realization. Any questions on this?
In the paragraph 8, the phrase "the mind enters into it and acquires confidence, steadiness, and resolution."
Yeah.
What does that mean?
The way I understand this, it doesn't mean that one is actually entering in by way of realization. What this means, this is the way I understand it, is because it says that when the Dhamma is being taught to someone for the cessation of Sakkaya. So this is when somebody is listening to the Dhamma being taught in that way. Then the mind gets inspired by that as the goal and then builds up this, it's called pasada, which means, here it's translated acquiring confidence, but the mind becomes calm or placid in the sense of that this is a goal, let's say it's that this is a goal that inspires the mind, so that the mind becomes tranquil when one fixes one's mind on that ideal or goal. And then steady, let me just santitati, yeah. The mind settles upon it, to say becomes firm in it. The mind settles down upon it, becomes stabilized, it settles upon that. And then, here I take the reading Adimuchati. I see the PTS edition has Vimuchati, which means is liberated. But I don't find that satisfactory because at this point one is not yet liberated. But a better reading, Adimuchati, which means that one resolves upon it in the sense one makes a commitment, an inner commitment to reach that goal.
I'm wondering if that corresponds at all to the second fetter of doubt, this phrase. The reason I'm thinking about that is I'm wondering if there are indications in paragraph 8 and at the beginning of paragraph 9 which would indicate that what is already Sakkaya. So if he's eradicated doubt, that.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't see that as indicating that one has eradicated doubt. Yes.
You said before that you can one can enter into the first jhana and then eradicate five lower fetters. Can one also enter the first jhana and then only reach non-returner state, weaken the fourth and fifth fetter?
I mean, reach once returner stage. I would certainly think if one can reach non-returner, one could certainly reach the two lower attainments, stream entry and once returner.
But that could also be a result. That could also be where you reach.
Yeah. But here I think the Buddha wants to place special emphasis on this method to show that it can reach either the fourth fruition or the third fruition. If he were to so show that it can reach the first or second, it wouldn't be giving such a high recommendation to it. Any other questions? Yeah.
I noticed this one doesn't mention the fourth form of attainment.
I'm going to...
Oh, we're not there yet. Okay.
Yeah, I just took the first jhana.
I have one other question. Previous to that, you're talking about the fetters. Can you... just mention what the Pali word is that you used to translate as appearance and now you translate as long grasp.
Paramasa. Paramasa.
What does that mean?
Like, masa means to touch. Amasa has the sense of to grasp. And para usually gives a sense of turning around the meaning, so it's wrong grasp. Yeah.
Back to the earlier question about how the mind is to enter into it, have confidence that that's an illusion. How does one balance those attributes and not have clinging or desire? It would seem like you're desiring to want to have those attributes.
Of the confidence... The confidence, steadiness, and resolution. At the beginning, it's good to have that desire. One shouldn't think that desire is always an obstacle to be eliminated, but desire is actually a positive force in cultivation, because desire is what motivates one to develop wholesome qualities. It's just that when one reaches this very highest point, which is what's explained when one is focusing the mind on the deathless element, that's where that very subtle desire has to be removed in order to make the final complete breakthrough. But in order to move up to that point, one needs desire as a driving factor, a driving force. But of course, it has to be moderated. It can't be like ambition. But it has to be a wholesome desire in the sense that one understands the benefits of developing these wholesome qualities. Okay, I want to go on to try to finish the sutta. It looks like a lot, but it isn't really very much because most of it is repetitive. Okay, we go in paragraphs 10 to 12. It just repeats the same pattern for the other jhanas. Then paragraph 13, we go to the formless attainments. And here, everything is the same except in the contemplation with insight. You'll notice whatever exists therein of feeling, perception, the formations and consciousness, he sees those states as impermanent and so on. And so what is dropped out is material form, right? Why is material form dropped out? Read the first phrase in paragraph 13.
You said because we're in the formless section.
Yeah. With a complete surmounting or complete overcoming of perceptions of form. So there's no perception of form here. So there's still bodily form is still there in these formless attainments, since the meditator still has a body, but one is not perceiving any form in that state, and so one can't contemplate any form that one is not perceived, that one hasn't perceived. Okay, and then it goes from the base of infinite space to the base of infinite consciousness to the base of nothingness. The base of nothingness is the third of the four formless attainments. And the same pattern of contemplation is applied to the base of nothingness. And then it stops with the base of nothingness. No mention is made of the fourth formless attainment, called the base of neither perception nor non-perception. The reason given, I don't think it's actually explained in the sutta itself, but what's said in the commentaries is that this base of neither perception nor non-perception is extremely subtle. And so, because it's extremely subtle, it's too difficult to analyze that state into its constituent factors by way of feeling, perception, the mental formations, and consciousness. One just gets a very general sense of this very peaceful, quiescent, meditative attainment, in which all of these mental factors become so subtle that one cannot even say that they are functioning the way they normally function. And yet they're still present in some degree. But one cannot really discern them clearly in order to contemplate them. So that's why it's not made an object for examination with insight. But it said that the Buddha can examine it with insight, but not others. Okay, and then at the very end, there's a strange question. Venerable Ananda says, if this is the path, the way to abandoning the five lower fetters, then how is it that some monks here are said to gain deliverance of mind, the liberation of mind, and some are said to gain deliverance by wisdom, liberation by wisdom. And then the Buddha says, the difference, Ananda, lies in their faculties. The reason why I say the question is somewhat strange is because whenever the attainment of arhantship is described, it's always said to be, in the stock formula, to be the liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom. So that arhantship always has both kinds of liberation. It's a liberation of mind, because the mind is freed from all of the defilements. And it's a liberation by wisdom, because wisdom is what brings this liberation. But here, I think the intention of the question is that some monks, when they gain arhatship, they have very strong samadhi. And so they are said to be liberated to have liberation of mind, because they have the ability to go through all the different samadhis and maybe to exercise the psychic powers. And others don't have such skill in samadhi, but they have very sharp faculties of wisdom, insight, and understanding. And so the Buddha's answer just says that the difference lies in their faculties. Then we could raise the question, why do they have these different faculties? Anybody have any questions? Yeah.
If he mentions seven attainments as race or ban and five moral fetters, I'm wondering why only the four jhanas are mentioned as right concentration.
In the Noble Eightfold Path.
There are a number of sutras where he mentions the higher, the
Yeah. My guess is that the four jhanas would be routinely expected of, in the Buddha's time, or they would have been fairly widespread attainments amongst monastics. And so the Buddha included them in the definition of right concentration. But the formless attainments were not emphasized so much by the Buddha. But they were part of the meditative culture pre-existed his appearance on the Indian scene. And so in order to complete his presentation of the whole range of possibilities and the development of concentration, he included them within various schemes of practice. But he didn't put as much emphasis upon them as he did upon the four jhanas. That's my guess. So I haven't actually seen this question discussed before. Any further questions? Okay, then we will stop for the evening. Next week, we don't have a class since I'll be away. So the next class will be in December, December 5th, I think. And that will be Sutta number 52, the Attanagara Sutta. Okay, we end by sharing the merits. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mangparang. Etavata cha ammehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe deva anumodantu. Sabba sampati siddhya etavata caam hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampatti siddhya.